Here in America, work is in trouble. We've offshored our manufacturing, sent away good jobs, and lost so much ability to make things. American Giant is a company that's pushing back against this tide. They make high-quality clothing, sweatshirts, jeans, dresses, jackets, and so much more right here in the USA. Visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com. Promo code STAPLE20.
You know, some people enjoy composing their own music, chord by chord, and others are happiest when they come across that one perfect song. Work is not a lot different than that. Whether you prefer building your own workflow or using a pre-made template, with Monday.com, you and the team can work in a way that's comfortable for everyone. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com and build your own amazing workflow, or find an awesome template. No judgment.
Hi folks, be sure to visit my website at dr-history.com for a short personal video message, to listen to the latest stories, and to leave a comment.
Good morning to Dr. History.
Good morning, Zeb.
How are you?
I'm great. Had a great 4th of July weekend. Had all my kids, all my grandkids here for the weekend.
What kind of numbers?
28 of us.
28 of you.
Yeah, 6 kids and their spouses and 14 and a half grandkids.
Watermelon, ice cream.
Hamburgers.
Who did the cooking?
I did some. I've got a nephew.
And they're still okay, right?
They're still alive this morning. I've got a nephew that has a big cooker thing. He made...
you mean like a
corn,
Traeger?
No. It's like a big wok. It's a big, like a big pot.
Really?
And he makes scones and he makes...
Well, I didn't overlook my invitation, did I?
It probably got lost in the mail.
I see. Which is understandable.
Anyway, it was a great weekend. Went to the Rupert Parade and enjoyed that as usual. So,
you know, you came in here with a glow, and that must be the reason.
You know, it's just... It is a, you know, the 4th of July, I love.
Yeah.
I love the 4th
yep.
of July.
Yep.
I love the music. I love the patriotism, the pride in our country. What can I say?
Absolutely.
I love that.
And I'm proud of you for saying that. I really am. So, okay, do we have any people that we need to thank?
Not today, but so I'm going to, the title of the story today is called The Men Who Handled the Ribbons.
What?
The men who handled the ribbons.
I know, I heard you the first time. I just didn't understand it.
The stagecoach drivers.
Oh,
okay.
Why didn't you say the reins?
Well, because that's not what the title says here.
Okay, well, go ahead.
So we're going to talk some stagecoach stories. How's that?
I get frustrated. Every time I see a stagecoach on TV, they're always running those horses at a full gallop. And they didn't do that.
No, only if they were being chased. And that was it.
I couldn't believe it. I've talked to Ray Bagby about that, and Ray and I are both mad about that.
Yeah, he has a beautiful stagecoach that he has built from the ground up.
Absolutely.
Just an amazing piece of work. But Mark Twain, you know, and a lot of other writers, they wrote about the pictures of frontier stage drivers, and in their own words, these old accounts sometimes seem exaggerated to a modern generation, but stage drivers were a remarkable breed. They had a position of popular reverence that rivaled even the saloon owners. And one writer wrote this. He said, "He is a lord in his way, the captain of his craft, the fear of timid passengers, the admiration of the stable boys, and the trusty agent of his employer. He prides himself in being expert in his profession, to which all other occupations and professionals are subordinate."
Woo!
He is king of the road, so to speak.
I wonder how many of them ever fell off.
That probably happened. Well, you know.
I darn near did.
Well, I've been on stagecoaches just. And not going over rough ground.
Oh.
Yeah. So, yeah. But, you know, once out on the road, passengers found the trip was a unique experience. Its appeal, like so many other things, depended upon the individual. An Englishman, Sir Henry Huntley, on a trip between Sacramento and Placerville, was upset because there was no class distinction among passengers.
Wait a minute.
He was disturbed by the frequent use of tobacco by, quote, dirty citizens, and the blasphemous language of the stage drivers when two coaches met on the road.
Oh, so he thought that he was above that.
Exactly.
I see. Kind of like your attitude.
Now, Zeb, come on. Me and you are on the same... whatever.
The bottom level.
The bottom level. Now, other travelers enjoyed stage driving immensely. One guy named Barthwick wrote that, quote, to sit behind four horses tearing along a good road is delightful at any time.
Really?
So he loved it.
Didn't mind the dust.
Didn't mind any of that.
And the heat.
Yeah. Now, a person named Dame Shirley recalled a stage journey in 1851, perhaps a more typical traveler, and wrote later of both the pleasures and the tribulations of a coach ride. Quote, she said, I seated myself in the most excruciating springless wagon that it was ever my lot to be victimized in, and commenced my journey in earnest. For 30 miles, the road passed through as beautiful a country as I'd ever seen, dotted here and there with a California oak. It reminded me of the peaceful apple orchards and smiling river meadows of dear old New England. Later, when her coach entered the hilly, mountainous mining country, the trip became a little more of a strain. Here's what she said, quote, for more than a mile, we drove along the edge of a precipice, and so near that it seemed to me, should the horses deviate a hair's breadth from their usual track, we must be dashed to eternity.
They had an eloquent way of saying,
you're
going to die.
Yeah. You and I just said, oh my gosh, we're dead.
I have a question that I know you have. You wouldn't ask because you're probably not, you know, as low class
true,
as I am sometimes.
True. Okay. Go ahead.
When a stagecoach was rolling along and somebody up in the stagecoach said, driver, I have to go to the bathroom, what did they do?
I'm going to assume it depended on who it was.
Oh, you're hedging.
I am, because it would be just up to the stage driver and his patience and whether he's on schedule or not.
Patience?
Yes.
In some cases, that can't be utilized.
Or none.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, another stage passenger remarked on the more universal inconveniences of coaching, commented that the roads were quite, quote, disagreeably dusty. And that throughout the mining country, passengers were, quote, jarred and shaken without mercy.
I see.
Now, as the elements, nature, you know, road agents, Indians weren't enough to cope with, stage passengers had to endure poor accommodations, terrible food, miserable roads, and a lot of times overloaded coaches. In towns and cities, stage passengers were usually able to be put up at a halfway decent hotel. But in the mining country during the early days, it was often a different story. A stage traveler described Sonora's best hotel as, quote, a one-story structure built of unhewn saplings, covered with canvas, and floored with dirt. It consists of one undivided room in which the tables, berths, and benches are all arranged. Here we sleep, eat, and drink. Four or five tiers of berths or bunks, one directly above the other, are built against the walls of the cabin. The bedding is composed of a small straw mattress about 2 feet wide, an uncased pillow, and a single blanket.
Sounds like all the comforts of home.
Yeah. I mean, what's wrong with that? I wouldn't
and
complain.
And that was the beginning of various motel chains.
It was. It really was, Deb. Another guy, a traveler out of Stockton in 1851, wrote that the stage station fare, the food, consisted of, quote, tough beefsteak, boiled potatoes, stewed beans, a nasty compound of dried apples, and a jug of molasses. Now, that wouldn't sit real good with me.
So far, you haven't done anything to really make me want to have lunch, I'll tell you
no,
that.
But, you know, the dirty condition of the roadside inns and the stage stops was, generally speaking, confined to the 1850s, and at worst was a very minor problem compared to some of the other hazards. A certain Mrs. Evoy was traveling on a stage between Marysville and Tehama, in 1853. She was 70 years old and was carrying $1,800 in gold dust in two purses. Now, most of the day and evening, she'd been passing the time, engaged in conversation with Colonel Harper.
Good old Colonel.
Colonel Harper.
Yeah.
Okay, a fellow passenger. A newspaper account of the affair neglects to mention that she discovered her purses were missing.
Uh-oh.
But her cries of robbery brought the stage grinding to a halt.
Really?
She discovered.
So they're inside the coach.
And she yells, robbery.
Inside the coach.
Yeah, yeah. So the driver tumbled everybody out of the coach, but before an inquiry got fairly underway, Colonel Harper, now picture this, threw off his cape and demanded to be searched. Now, one of the passengers, a little bit cynical, immediately picked up the cape and found one of the missing purses in his pocket. So I think he did this as a show, like, hey, I wouldn't steal from this lady, you know, here. I'm going to take off my cape. Well,
yeah. And it turned out he had a red S on his chest. Superman, with a cape.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
We'll move on. Anyway, so, and the poke that they found had Mrs. Evoy's name on it. So, of course, and the colonel, of course, he didn't know how the purse had gotten in his cape, but he was hustled back to the nearest ranch and tried before a justice of the peace. And at his trial, it was brought out that he had been particularly attentive to Mrs. Evoy all day, and some of the passengers had seen him walk out of sight of the stage with her carpet bag.
Oh.
It was presumed that this is when he substituted rocks wrapped in paper for the two purses of dust, and he narrowly missed being lynched and was glad to be turned over to the authorities at the next nearest town.
So he was lucky he didn't get hung.
He was.
Wow.
I mean, if they'd have had their way, he'd have been swinging. But a lot of times in movies you see these wide open prairie roads with stagecoaches, right? But narrow mountain roads were, they were very common. These real narrow roads, and sometimes they caused a tragedy. In 1875, a guy named Andy Morris was driving stage out of Eureka when he met a wagon going in the opposite direction.
This isn't good.
On a narrow trail.
Ooh.
The wagon driver, Charlie Groots, pulled his team up on the inside bank so that the stage could pull around him on the outside.
So the stage was on the lip of the cliff.
But, well, no, the one has stopped, and he was on the inside.
Yeah.
But his wheels were kind of up, elevated a little bit.
So yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah.
Okay. So as Morris, the other guy, kind of edged his coach around the wagon, Groots' vehicle, the one that had stopped, which had been parked at too steep an angle, suddenly tipped over onto the stage horses of the guy that was passing.
Oh.
The animal spooked and jumped off the cliff, taking themselves and the coach down a drop of several hundred feet. There were no passengers, and the driver jumped off, and miraculously the stage stopped. The animal survived. But
they did?
Yeah, but the coach was smashed to pieces.
Well, imagine that.
Yeah, a couple of hundred feet. So,
you know, I was wondering about those narrow roads. I can't remember the movie, but my goodness, I mean, we're talking where the rim of the wheels was like right on the edge.
Yeah, yeah. You would hope your driver was paying real close attention.
And you would hope the horses were paying real close attention,
yeah,
too.
Yeah. You know, the accidents were by far the most dangerous aspect of coach travel. The road agents, you know, the robbers and the hold-up men, they were always a present source of trouble from 1851 until after the turn of the century. The bandits and the highwaymen were pioneers, too, and they set the stage for the next 50 years of Western outlaws. And what colorful characters they were. You know, legendary figures, feared and desperate men like Joaquin Murrieta.
I
remember him.
Oh, yeah.
Joaquin was one of the earliest, most publicized bandits. And although he wasn't known to necessarily hold up stagecoaches, but he would rob mining settlements, pack trains, things like that. There's another guy, Tom Bell, Rattlesnake Dick.
He's no relation to me, by the way.
I wasn't even going to suggest that.
Thank you.
Tom Bell, Rattlesnake Dick Barter, Dick Fellows. Let's see, who else? Oh, we've got a guy named Charles Bowles, alias Black Bart. You've heard of him.
Oh, yeah. Wasn't he from Idaho?
Well, you know what, Zeb? I did a story on Black Bart, and there turns out there was about two or three of those Black Barts.
Because I remember one you talked about here in Idaho.
Yeah. And so Black Bart was kind of a, seemed like a good name to pick up.
Oh.
Because it seemed like there was two or three of those guys that took on the name Black Bart.
How did they get their nicknames?
Well, you know, if you lost a finger or you lost your scalp, or there could be names associated with certain disfigurements, and I'll just leave it at that and let you think about that.
I'm pondering.
I know you are. So one morning in 1874, a stage out of Hollister was stopped by a tall man with a shotgun and a short 16-year-old girl named Lizzie Keith. The driver threw down the payroll of the of a mine that he was carrying and then kept on his way. On his return trip, the driver was again held up at the same spot.
Same spot.
By the same people. But this time, he had enough of their nonsense. He lashed out with his whip. The driver knocked the shotgun from the bandit's grip and then grabbed the pistol from the girl. And with the help of a passenger, the two bandits were put on into the stage and driven into Hollister, where they were deposited in the local jail.
No kidding.
Now, you know, Teamsters used whips,
yeah.
You know, but stage drivers, you don't think as much, but somebody with a good skill with whip, they were feared as much as anybody with a gun.
Lash LaRue.
Yeah. So.
Remember him?
I remember the name. Yeah. But after the turn of the century, you know, passengers themselves were usually the targets of robberies, and not so much the gold-laden treasure box of an express company. Such incidences were not as frequent as is generally supposed, but they did happen, and often enough that at least one express company had forms made up so drivers could easily report a holdup. Wells Fargo alone reported 313 robberies and 34 attempted robberies during a 14-year period.
Holy smokes.
313. But they had a special form made up so the driver could just fill out, probably said, you know, description, what time, where were you.
Did the drivers, when they made a run, let's say from Sacramento to someplace, okay, did they turn around right away and go all the way back, or did they have like a day or two layover? What was the deal?
Well, and that depended a lot, because a lot of times they did. A driver would drive from his station to the next station and turn around and drive back to the station, his home station. But there were situations where a driver would carry on to, say, from Virginia City, Montana. He might drive to a home station, stay overnight, then continue on to, say, Fort Hall, and then on down to Salt Lake. And then maybe wait a couple of days and then make the return trip all the way from Salt Lake clear back to Virginia City.
I see.
So,
okay.
But, you know, there are just some pretty amazing stories. There's one here I skipped over. I'm going to go back and tell.
Well,
this
just
one.
To be a driver of a stagecoach, you had to be a guy that really had some strong hands and strong arms, because you're talking about a vehicle led by four horses or six.
Right, yeah.
And it had to be a long day.
Yes. And like I say, they were the toughest, the bravest, you know. And I can't find the story I was looking for.
I know, your shifty eyes.
Well, keep talking, Jim.
No, but, you know, I don't know if you can see it. It's up there. I want you to look at that picture before you leave of me on that stagecoach. It's on the wall right there behind that little picture. And there's not much to balance on when you're up in that driver's seat.
Yeah.
Nothing.
So I'm just going to remember this story or tell the story from memory, because we have a few minutes.
Okay, we got 3 minutes.
So a stagecoach was going along, and the stage driver, they hit something, the stage driver got knocked off his seat, okay? And so the horses took off on a dead run. Well, inside the stagecoach was a guy named Mr. Lutz. He climbed out of the stagecoach. Now, keep in mind, it's running full speed with these horses at a full gallop. He climbs out, climbs up onto the seat, but the reins are down, dragging on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So he jumps down onto the tree, the single tree or the double tree, whatever, I can't remember, between the horses, and then reaches down to grab the reins and then is able to jump onto one of the horses and is able to pull the stage to a stop. And could have been, if he'd fallen, you know, he'd have been trampled and run over by the stage. That's a true story.
And I know, and that act of heroism was imitated in a couple of early movies. And the stuntman, Yakima Canutt, imitated that same thing, and he was the first man ever to pull that off.
Wow!
In the movies,
and he did the real thing.
He did the real thing,
yeah.
On the runaway stage, Yakima Canutt. He was a great bronc rider, Indian cowboy, and he was hired to do these movies. And he was the first one that did that stunt. He actually was sliding along, holding onto that single tree, and then got the reins and got up there and stopped the horses. You could not pay me enough.
No. Anyway, those are just a few stories about the men who held the ribbons.
And I'll tell you what, being in a stagecoach, what was a day like? I mean, 8 hours, or did they go, long did they go?
You know, they had the swing stations where they'd change horses, and then the home stations, which were farther apart. And so they'd be able to at least get off and rest for while they changed horses. So, but still, I'm going to guess sometimes even 12-hour days.
Really?
Just to guess.
I would rather have ridden up on top.
Right, where you could see and have fresh air. And
maybe
not
stretch your legs a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But sometimes they had as many as 17 people in a stage, on a stage.
Wow.
I mean, the inside was packed, and people riding on top and hanging on.
I hate to say this, but there's always going to be somebody that forgets their right guard.
You think there might be inside the stage?
Yeah.
That's why you had open windows.
There you go. Do another story next week on stagecoaches. I love that. And we ought to get Bagby on here. I mean, man alive, the three of us together, that'd be really interesting.
Ray, and he also has a hearse that he's built. Have you seen that?
Not yet.
He has a beautifully made hearse. I mean, inside satin with the frills hanging and the windows.
My.
Just a beautiful piece of work.
What good are windows on a hearse?
Well,
nothing. I'll leave you alone.
Thank you.
Okay. That's as bad as naked people smoking in a nudist colony. Okay, here we go. Well, we wrecked this morning's program. I want to see what you're going to do on that tape. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. History.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.